You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast on this most glorious of Monday mornings. Matt is here. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Sorry, that's all I've got.
Great chat, Matt. Good job. David is here as well. Hello, David.
Oh, I've got lots of chat. I've been to another country and it was marvellous. And I've been watching tennis in the middle of the night still, so not everything's changed. But it's been marvellous. And now I've got loads of energy to just take over the show with.
Unfortunately, David, that energy is going to be wasted because nobody from Solihull has done anything of any note this week.
No, that was a bit you missed ill-timed. Your chance. I couldn't believe it. I'd got all these takes.
Okay, I'm going to award you 30 seconds now for your Solihull Dan Evans takes. Because Matt's got no chat today, apparently. So here you go.
Well, it was a long time coming, Dan, to be quite honest, and you've managed to time it for exactly when I wasn't around. So thanks a bunch.
David Law takes, David, not Dan Evans takes.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's good, isn't he? He's actually better than I thought he was, and then he went and lost in the first round to somebody I'd never heard of. So maybe we're just about back where we started.
Yeah, but players, I mean, he wasn't alone at least, was he? Players that had been successful the week before did struggle in Canada last week. So maybe we'll grant him a free pass on that. He plays
Alex
Lorenzo Musetti later, doesn't it? Apart from Alex. Okay, well, you're going to be fun today, aren't you, Matt?
Matt with the facts to ruin our fun.
Yes, lots of Alex de Minaur chat coming up in today's pod. Finalist, of course, in Toronto. We will wrap up all the action that we've seen since Thursday in Toronto and Montreal and look ahead to Cincinnati, which, of course, tennis being tennis, has already started. Matt, this time in 7 days, we will be T-minus 24 minutes away from takeoff for New York City. Got anything to say about that? Any chat on that?
I would say that we're planning another departure lounge pod, aren't we? And we've done some learning from the last time we did one of those, where it was a very, very stressful upload experience walking through Gatwick Airport, trying desperately to get on some sort of 4G or 5G or Wi-Fi so that we could transfer a file over to David. We did it with seconds to spare. This time,
in the boarding queue.
Yeah, this time we're planning to get there earlier and record in a stress-free environment. That's the plan.
Hashtag learnings. Mm. Hashtag learnings. Yep. All being well, this time 7 days from now, we'll have recorded our Monday pod and we will be once again in the boarding queue for our flight to New York City for the 2023 US Open. And the Tennis Podcast today is brought to you in association with the US Open Tennis Championship. Should we be calling it that? Have I been calling it the wrong name all these years?
Maybe we've been sort of short-forming it all this time, you know?
Yeah, and, okay.
Here we go. Doing
the
it
US
proper.
Open. The US Open is one of the world's highest attended annual sporting events and renowned for providing fans with an unparalleled experience, equal parts sport and spectacle. In 2023, the US Open celebrates 50 years of equal prize money for men and women tennis players. In 1973, the US Open became the first of the four Grand Slam tournaments to offer equal prize money, a pioneering move that shook the sport and began to reshape it towards a more equitable future. And by the way, the poster for this year's US Open is a celebration of the 50 years of equal prize money, and it is Billie Jean King themed, and it is epic, and I'm already planning where in my flat I will be placing the framed 2023 US Open poster that I'm planning to buy.
That's such a good idea. I'm going to get everything they've got with that image on it, because it is amazing. I agree.
It's really, really cool, the poster this year. I mean, obviously we were going to love a poster that celebrates the 50 years of equal prize money, but it is aesthetically excellent as well. They really have done a cracking job. The main draw for this year's US Open takes place August 28th to September 10th, so it's just 2 weeks away now. Before even then, the US Open kicks off with Fan Week, which begins Tuesday, August 22nd, and runs to Sunday, August 27th, or 27th. Rather, you can get in free for any of the 6 days, and there'll be some amazing tennis, star-studded events and activities for all. There are also ticketed, featured events during Fan Week that you won't want to miss. Stars of the Open on Wednesday, August 23rd, will feature exhibition matches, including defending US Open champion Carlos Alcaraz, Alina Svitolina, Francis Tiafoe, Maria Sakkari, Chris Eubanks, Jessica Pegula, Matteo Berrettini, and... Bianca Andreescu's on this list, but spoiler alert for some news that we'll be bringing you later. I rather suspect Bianca Andreescu will not be on this list next time we read it out. But anyway, John McEnroe is still on this list for the retro lovers amongst you. Flavours of the US Open, the US Open's signature culinary event, is back on Thursday, August 24th, and will offer attendees a wide range of food and beverage offerings, coupled with celebrity chefs and top tennis talent on the court. To learn more about everything happening at the 2023 US Open, visit usopen.org. Right then, let's head to Montreal, where Jessica Pegula is the champion. She beat Ludmila Samsonova 6-1, 6-love in the final. An incredible performance from Jessica Pegula. The same can be said of her whole week. The final itself, a diminished spectacle. In fact, the whole final day's tennis in Montreal, a diminished spectacle because of rain, quite frankly. We had the second semi-final between Samsonova and Rybakina being played earlier on the Sunday, and then after suitable rest, the winner of that, Samsonova, coming back to play Pegula, who'd made her way through to the final the day before. And the whole thing felt from the moment that first semi-final, the semi-final on finals day, the Samsonova-Rybakina match, from the moment that got going and felt weird, I kind of had a sense of doom about that whole day's tennis. I had a sense that it was going to be defined, not just the fact that somebody was going to have to play two matches in one day, but the inequality of it, the fact that Pegula had booked her place in the final nearly 24 hours before, and it just always felt like it was going to be bad as a spectacle for the neutral. And let's be honest, David, it was quite bad as a spectacle for the neutral, both those matches in different ways, I think.
Yeah, I was so excited to be back from holiday and able to watch these matches live. Certainly, I didn't watch the final on catch-up, but the semi played on final day with Rybakina and Samsonova, I tuned in. I sort of planned my cooking around it so that I could watch all of it while I was doing my cooking. And it was it was a horror show, really, of a match from start to finish, because neither one of them played well at the same time. And Rybakina was good in the first set. Samsonova looked completely overwhelmed by the occasion and lost it 6-1. And then three double faults, I think, in the first game of the second set from Rybakina, and her serve. I was listening to your chat the other day where you referenced, Matt, that she'd had her serve broken 10 times and still won a match. And, you know, how can that be? How can she still be in the tournament? And her serve was all over the place. But I was sort of in denial in the early stages of that first set, Catherine. You talk about the feeling of doom. Really, that's what was everywhere. That was what was in the atmosphere, because everybody knew it's not fair. This shouldn't be happening. I mean, it is tennis. It is what happens when there is rain at tennis sometimes. But it just feels terribly inadequate and unsatisfactory. And poor old Rybakina, who'd been playing these terribly late night matches. She had this incredible match against Daria Kasatkina, which was of an exceptionally high quality, but finished at 3 a.m. Then she's having to wait all day for this semi-final to happen that doesn't. And that is tiring in itself, isn't it? Just sitting around trying to do, are we going to play, are we not? And then this final day takes a bit of the gloss off the achievement for Jessica Pegula, which is unfair to her as well. So it's just a bummer, really, the whole thing.
Yeah, bummer, Matt. That just about sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and I think Pegula referenced that in her press conference and kind of in her reaction, I think, immediately to winning that title. You know, this was a huge moment in her career, her second Masters 1000 title. And immediately afterwards, I think actually her thoughts were kind of with Samsonova, because she recognised that it kind of wasn't a fair fight in that final with Samsonova having just played her semi-final. The emotion eventually came out, and Pegula, I think, recognised it was a big moment for her as well. But yeah, she said in her press conference, it was unsatisfactory. I would like to have played her on sort of equal footing and we could have gone from there. But yeah, really the sort of doom and gloom started, as David said, a few days before, with that day where there was rain and they were having to play catch up, and they had to play three night session matches effectively. Well, perhaps they didn't have to, but they chose to play three night session matches, and that meant that Rybakina Kasatkina came on court at about quarters of midnight, I think, and it was almost 3 o'clock in the morning by the time they finished. And Rybakina was pretty outspoken about that, in a way that some players are often not. You know, some players talk about 3 a.m. finishes. Oh, it's just a fact of tennis. I think more and more players are speaking out against that. And Rybakina said that this poor leadership in the WTA was the statement that she said, and that they need to do something about that. You know, it needs to be a red line. We cannot be playing matches that late. And I think she felt like, even though she got through that match, her tournament was kind of ruined. She had no chance afterwards of actually going on and being a meaningful contender. And we saw that in her performance against Samsonova. And I think Samsonova herself had already played two matches on one day prior to the finals day, having to do that as well. So a sort of excessive workload on 2 days. It was just all a bit of a mess. And then it was that side of the draw that was really affected, whereas Jessica Pegula kind of coasted, well, not coasted through. She had very difficult matches that she had to come through, but managed to avoid all of that drama, and then had much more left in the final and played a pretty perfect performance against a weakened opponent.
I wonder if Rybakina's strength of feeling about the subject and willingness or keenness to speak out about it was crystallised or formulated during the experience she had in Rome with the final there against Angelina Kalinina ending up being played, I mean, not as late as the quarterfinal in Montreal, but after a whole day of delays. I think it ended up going on court about 11 p.m. after men's semi-finals, absolutely nobody in the crowd, it's damp. Kalinina ends up retiring mid-match, suffering from sort of stress-induced injury, I believe. You know, the biggest biggest match of her career and having to wait around all day. And then Steve Simon is there for the presentation and there's booing. There's booing throughout the presentation. It's unclear who the booing is for, but it's all just horrifying, really. Deeply uncomfortable and unsatisfactory for absolutely everybody involved. And I don't think you need to lay blame at anyone's feet. Obviously, I know that nobody can control the weather. I increasingly do think tennis tournaments without roofs are maybe not viable. But that's not an issue that can be solved overnight. But it just shouldn't be happening. Tennis just needs to get together and agree. This can't happen. Doesn't matter whose fault in it, who's to blame. We need to have some red lines in place here as a sport to prevent this from happening. Curfew, red line for times matches can go on court. Obviously, you can't anticipate how long a match is going to last for. But matches shouldn't be going on in at a time when you know there's zero way it can finish before midnight unless a player gets injured. That just shouldn't be on the table for the sport, I don't think.
Well, I agree. And I think now the upside to the extension of these tournaments with Canada and Cincinnati going to be joining Madrid and Madrid and Rome as being these 2 week long events like Indian Wells and Miami are as well. The upside is that you're going to have more days to play with, and it will be absolutely unacceptable if they are not able to implement
like they did in Rome,
that exact
David.
Rule. Well, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's unacceptable not to use those days in that way.
But they're not. They're not. What the 2 week events are doing is extending week one. They're still, generally speaking, stacking week two.
Well, I just don't think that they can no longer have any excuse about the weather. They can. I will just hammer them every single time without any type of caveat whatsoever. Now, if that continues with these longer events, because they've got the time built in to these long-winded, meandering, when will it ever end tournaments, which is something I don't particularly look forward to, really, having experienced it from Madrid and Rome this year. But I understand that they're doing it. That's going to be the reality. Okay, well, what's the upside? That's one of the upsides. It should be, at least. And because I do really sympathise with organisers in Montreal trying to just get their tournament played in those conditions. It's a bloody nightmare, and I feel terrible for Rebecca. Now, you know, she's come away from that event probably having had just a really miserable experience and really potentially damaging her whole summer. Because I don't think you come back from a week like that with a click of the fingers.
Yeah, and look, the last time she was physically right was Rome, wasn't it? The start of Rome. She suffered from that virus, Roland Garros. We don't think she's been quite right all summer. And I'm not suggesting that's direct cause and effect, but it is not good for tennis players in an already a sport that is demanding these players to be absolutely physically, relentlessly at their limits. It is not good for tennis players to be sitting around all day, not knowing when they're going to get on court for one of the biggest matches of their lives, experiencing that kind of bodily stress, continually warming up and then unproductively warming up. It's no good. It's no good for anyone. Let's talk about the positives. An incredibly positive week for Jessica Pegula. I don't read massive amounts into the final, but I do read a lot into previous matches that she played in the week, particularly, of course, her victory over Iga Świątek in the semi-finals, over Coco Gauff in the quarterfinals. She was awesome all week, but awesome in a very Jessica Pegula way. I noticed Christopher Clary, formerly of the New York Times, on Twitter explaining a bit to a couple of people in his mentions that were querying how on earth Jessica Pegula is at the ranking she is and having the success that she is when her game looks on the face of it so unspectacular relative to the others around her in the rankings. And it is a less spectacular style of play. It requires more nuance, I think, to analyse exactly what makes her so good. And it requires some really unsexy language, like precision and clever tactics. You know, there were some really interesting stats on Saturday, subsequent to during the Pegula-Świątek match, about how many fewer forehands Świątek was hitting in that match. Her tactic, you know, she got a good backhand, but so much of Świątek's brilliance is she kind of always has the shot and the ball that she wants to hit. Players, opponents find it really difficult to make her uncomfortable, and she wasn't able to hit the shot that she wanted to hit a lot of the time on Saturday, which is that forehand, particularly the first shot after the serve. She's got an incredible knack of getting that ball on the forehand and taking immediate charge of the rally. And Jessica Pegula, with her precision and depth, was preventing her from doing that, both in the return games and on the serve, with her incredible precision on the serve. And I know these are unsexy words. It's a lot easier to talk about Alcaraz tweeners, isn't it? But I've got so much time and respect for the way that she is making herself a factor at the top of tennis.
If it hadn't been for Cotton Eye Joe, can we talk about that? Because that was my favourite moment of the week. So it's made my favourite moment of the year.
I just did a load of analysis and you're talking about a one-hit wonder from the 90s.
I think it's
all right, off you go.
Very relevant to the Jessica Pegula story this week.
Hang on, I'm doing the hardcore analysis and you're talking about Cotton Eye Joe. What sort of vortex have we entered?
The problem is that song is now just going to be associated with Jessica Pegula forever.
And I hate that song.
Do you? It's a guilty pleasure song for me. it is awful. It is objectively awful.
I think that's why it was so funny. It was that song at a crucial moment in the second set tiebreak against Iga Świątek. And the other stat that came up on the screen during that match was that points won since Cotton Eye Joe. And it was Iga Świątek.
When did it come on?
12 out of 12.
Mid-rally, right?
It was mid-rally in the second set tiebreak. And it came on when the ball was in mid-air. And I must say, Świątek hit an absolutely astonishing sort of forehand smash just as it came
on.
and then, obviously, the rally had to stop. And Čičak, the umpire, was like, a sound system, can we please sort that out?
It's such a... like, there's no... there's no slow intro to Cotton Eye Joe, is there?
No,
it comes
it just goes
right
in
with that singer's extremely irritating vocal. There's no soft launch.
Yeah, so, you know, Pegula tailspinned after that. She literally lost 12 points in a row after that song came on and ended up a breakdown in that third set.
Hang on, and yet you're suggesting she might not have won without Cotton Eye Joe?
No, I don't think I said that.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying it was a big moment for her to be able to sort of get the match back on track after Cotton Eye Joe had absolutely torpedoed her big win over Iga Świątek. You know?
Okay, well, I'll ask the question then. Would she have won without Cotton Eye Joe?
Yeah, I think she might have won in two sets. Like, I know she was a mini breakdown in that second set tiebreak, but she was awesome in this match. I mean, I'll now go into some tennis analysis, if finally, after 20 minutes of questionable contributions from me on this podcast. She broke Świątek's serve 11 times in that match, and 4 out of 4 in that opening set. And we have spoken all year about that being an area of Świątek's game that you have to target. And it was Pegula at United Cup, when she did it there, that made me realise that you really can attack Świątek's serve, and in particular her second serve. And Pegula did that better than I've seen anyone do it. Maybe Rybakina at Indian Wells was just as good, but Pegula in Montreal this week, absolutely brilliant. as you said, taking control of the rally straight away off Świątek's own serve. And she's also got so many sort of little subtle layers to her game, Pegula, that I think are underrated. Like her slice backhand, I think, is underrated. Her hand skills around the baseline, the way she can pick the ball up and sort of half volleys. Her movement, I think, is really underrated. It's not the most dynamic movement, but she gets a lot of balls back and defends really well. And these little incremental improvements are adding up to a player who, you know, in her words, I win a lot of matches. You know, I think she's very aware of people saying, well, what is her game? And she's like, well, this is my game and it works and I win a lot of matches and I'm constantly getting to the latter stages. And it doesn't feel to me like she's got a bit of a Grand Slam quarterfinal problem. You know, that's a hurdle that she still needs to overcome. But I don't get the same experience watching her late in big matches as I do watching Maria Sakkari, where it feels like there's a lot of stress. It feels like Pegula has lost some big matches simply because the opponent has played better. Whereas I feel like Sakkari has sometimes sort of let herself down in those matches with her performance. But Pegula now has beaten Coco Gauff and Iga Świątek this week, and she feels again going into the US Open like she did going into the Australian Open at the start of the year, where she's got a big win against Świątek, and you can't ignore that. I know slams are different, but that was huge for her to get that win, especially in those circumstances. And I'm sure we'll be having US Open mixed chat at some point, but Pegula, for me, feels like she might be in it now with the tennis she's playing.
Which is a really tricky one for me, because I agree with everything you've just said, Matt, and yet I picked her for the Australian Open on the basis of those United Cup performances and all subsequent analysis, and I got burned. So am I ready to be hurt again? the fundamental predictions question. I don't know. David?
Well, I would take issue with Matt a little over the comparison with Sakkari, because I think she's got a bigger problem than that suggests, and that it's not just about opponents. I think the last couple of times she's had real chances and she should have pressed them home. She should have converted one of those. And I think because her demeanour never changes and she doesn't look like she's stressed as such, maybe we don't label it as in the same way. And I think what she does incredibly well is gather herself from those disappointments and come again for the run of the mill tour. It never seems to tailspin into a problem at the next tournament. It's a Grand Slam problem. But I think she's got some work to do to convince that she is going to be able to handle the moment and deliver. You know, you've got to peek at these things, haven't you? And I suppose that's what you're getting at, is other people are peeking at the Grand Slams at those stages when she is not. She's still maybe staying the same level or actually diminishing a little. I think she's got to find something, and is yet to do it. And I still wonder whether. Yes, I do. I do, but I think some of it, to go along with what Matt is saying, is somewhat draw dependent, because if she runs into one of the top three or four when they're playing their best, I just don't think she's good enough then. But she's had I can't remember who she lost to now at the French Open and at Wimbledon.
Wimbledon was Vondroušová.
And that was a match where the roof closed and Vondroušová suddenly started playing really, really well under the roof.
I remember. I covered that, Matt. I did cover that match for BBC Radio. And I just feel like you've got to win that match if you're hurt. I know the woman went on to win the title. I get that. And it's Vondroušová and she can do that. But I still feel like, as a numbers game, if you end up playing Azarenka and Vondroušová and not Świątek, Rybakina and Sabalenka, you've got to take one of those.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think the Australian Open one is the one that I would point to as that was a match where Pegula didn't play her best level at all. Mm. That was disappointing. I think she was disappointed. I think the Vondroušová one was weird. I mean, she missed a backhand to go 5-1 up in that third set, granted. But after that, Vondroušová played fantastic tennis, you know, tournament-winning tennis, as we now know. I don't think Pegula did too much wrong in that third set against Vondroušová. But I agree, you know, cumulatively, she's had a couple of chances now against players that aren't Świątek and Rybakina and Sabalenka. But I don't know, it doesn't feel to me like she's really dropping her level in these matches. I think she's maybe not finding her absolute top level, and she needs that top level to win. But there was something about the way she recovered against Świątek in that third set. You know, she was 4-2 down in that third set against Świątek and won 16 of the last 19 points. Blazing forehand winners a lot of the time. Yes, Świątek maybe started overhitting and missing a little bit, but it was seriously good from Jessica Pegula. And I think she's in that spot where I don't know whether I'll pick her to win, but I don't think I'd be surprised if she does win, because her level is consistently great right now.
I also think significantly she's not got any specific issues with the big three. She's beaten them all. She's got winning head-to-heads against Rybakina and Sabalenka. And she's beaten Świątek as world number one twice now. And okay, some people have caveats against that win she had at the United Cup. The Polish team had travelled, hadn't they, from Perth the day before. But mentally, she's beaten Iga Świątek twice this year. And I think those things are really significant. I remember watching her match against Rybakina in Miami, Pegula. And look, she ended up losing that. But I was really struck by how that matchup kind of worked for Pegula. She was able to play her best tennis. I thought she might get blasted off the court ahead of that match. I remember previewing it on Amazon. I wasn't quite sure what it was going to look like. And it actually looked pretty okay for Jessica Pegula. I don't think she has the... I'm not waiting to see how the draw shakes out in the way that I am with Coco Gauff, for example, because I see Coco Gauff in Iga Świątek's section of the draw and I kind of go, well, it doesn't matter how well you're playing then. I don't feel that way for Jessica Pegula with any... I don't think there's anybody she can't beat if she brings her best. Mm. But bringing her best at a slam when it matters most is what we're yet to see. But I suspect it might be in there.
You'd back her best over the other three?
No, but I think it's possible. No, of course not. I'm backing the big three. They're the best three tennis players in the world, I believe, and they've been there and done it at slams, all three of them, and that is extremely significant. But I see Coco Gauff to face Iga Świątek in a quarter final, and I just feel like just cancel the match, you know. And I hope that will change as time goes on. But I'm worried about that head to head. I don't feel that way about any particular matchup for Jessica Pegula. I feel like on her day, she has it in her to beat them.
Yeah,
yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah, I. It's funny you brought up the question posed by Chris Clary. I actually increasingly enjoy watching Jessica Pegula just play the sport. And a lot of it is about her retrieving. I love it when she plays a big hitter. And you're right, she doesn't have these sort of million mile an hour legs going the way that Iga Świątek does. But her anticipation and her manipulation of a forehand slice and a backhand slice and just popping it back onto your baseline, I think is a good watch.
She's also got sneaky power. I think she's quite a powerful player, but because it's very consistent power, it's not explosive power. It can go a little unnoticed or under the radar, but it's very, very effective. And I'm very interested in how she performs at this US Open.
Just on Iga Świątek, it's quite interesting how her her tournament played out. It was a very un-Iga Świątek tournament in that she played all these really close, long matches. You know, just like, I think it was a tight first set against Pliskova and then three sets against Mukova and against Collins. A lot of rain delays too that she had to sort of deal with. Like, I think maybe she was a little bit sort of mentally exhausted going into that match against Jessica Pegula, but maybe again not the worst thing in the world for her to be having some tough matches. It does feel like she's not doing that thing of just winning easily or losing easily anymore. She does seem to be sort of since the latter stage of that French Open, she seems to be having a lot more sort of tougher matches. And I think in the same way that her 2021 season was a really good backing up of her breakthrough in 2020, where she sort of really sort of was consistent and reached the second week of slams and sort of kicked on in that way without winning big. I feel like this has been a really good backing up of last year, where she took it to another level. It was always going to be hard to sustain that, but she started to do things that she wasn't doing before, like coming through tough matches and not being beaten really easily. And she still won a slam and she's still racking up wins. Like, this has been a really, really good season for Iga Świątek, and she can make it almost just as good if she were to win the US Open again. But it just feels like, yes, there have been some doubts maybe at times, a bit of stress, we've sort of questioned, and she's questioned, you know, her sort of how much she loves being at the top of the sport. And all of that is still there in the background. And yet her results have just kept being so impressive. And it's taking great performances still to beat her. I feel like she's raised her floor again. And yeah, it's, even though she didn't win, it feels like she sort of gained something a little bit this week with all of those tough wins for Iga Świątek.
The doubles title in Montreal was won by Shuko Aoyama and Ina Shibahara. They saved two match points to defeat number five seeds Desiree Kravchuk and Demi Schuurs 6-4, 4-6, 13-11 in the final there. And yes, as alluded to earlier, last bit of news from Montreal is that Bianca Andreescu announced on social media yesterday that she has a stress fracture in her back. She obviously won't be playing in Cincinnati this week. I don't think she'll be playing the US Open. She hasn't said that, but I hope she's not playing the US Open. I know a little bit about stress fractures in backs, and rest is that there's no bending around that problem. You have to straight up bed rest the problem away, and if it doesn't heal correctly, it can lead to a lot of other issues. So I think we're just going to see another Bianca Andreescu absence from the sport, and that is devastating. She cannot catch a break, but we wish her well.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Over to Toronto now, where Jannik Sinner has finally broken his Masters 1000 duck. He beat Alex de Minaur 6-4, 6-1. In the final, a very impressive performance from him. From the semi-final point onwards, from the point Tommy Paul beat Carlos Alcaraz, Matt sent a message to the group and said, Jannik Sinner needs to be winning this tournament now. This is a test for him. And he did. He blooming well did. And very impressive. I know he didn't have to beat the absolute best of the best to do it, but he beat who was there. More unsexy analysis from me. He beat who was there. And I think this is significant for Jannik Sinner, because I always talk about, I'm always a bit of a dampener on the Jannik Sinner hype conversation, because I think he's a very methodical tennis player in every way, in the micro sense and in the macro sense. I always felt like he would win a 1000 before he would win a slam. I always felt like he would reach a Grand Slam semi-final and a final before he would win a slam. I feel like he will incrementally tick off the milestones. I do think he'll get there, but I think people naming no names, putting him in Grand Slam mixes for the past year, I think that is premature, personally. I still not sure I'm putting him in my US Open mix for that same reason. I think he might still have one or two more milestones to tick off before he does that. But I think this is a significant one on that trajectory.
Yeah. I think that word incremental is a good description of what Jannik Sinner is as a tennis player. Like, every year he does something a little bit better, whether it's winning more matches or winning a big title or getting further in a slam. He does do that every year, and I think his game improves every year. He's been tinkering with his serve for years. I don't think he served particularly well this week, but I think that shot will still get better. I just had this feeling as all these players were going out, Rune, Rublev, Tsitsipas, Ruud, Djokovic wasn't there, and then the two big ones, Alcaraz losing. That was maybe less of a thing for Sinner, because he has at least shown that he can hang with Alcaraz and beat Alcaraz. The really big one, I thought, was Medvedev going out, because he's got a really bad record against Medvedev.
He's got a Medvedev problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when he went out, I was like, okay, Jannik Sinner needs to win this. This is his chance to win a Masters 1000 title for the first time. And he was very impressive. He had a... Individually, I would have expected him to win all the matches that he played. But collectively, that's a lot of good wins he had. Gael Monfils, Tommy Paul, Matteo Berrettini in the first round. He was helped by maybe Andy Murray's withdrawal of their match. And then he absolutely kind of took de Minaur apart, really, in a way that he kind of always has in their matches. It was the first time I think I really paid attention to Jannik Sinner was the... back when I used to pay attention to the next gen finals, because they played the final of that in 2019, and Sinner absolutely just hit de Minaur off the court in that sort of fast and furious format. And he's sort of done that whenever they've then met on tour. I think de Minaur's only won one set against Sinner, and it was close for the first set, really. You know, Sinner kept getting the advantage and then giving it up.
It was close up until the point that I texted the group and said, this match is surprisingly good. And then Sinner poured a big bucket of cold water on it.
Yeah.
So but... if you can pour water on my hype train, I can pour water on yours.
Yeah, he was just relentless. You know, he hit such a big ball, and de Minaur was hanging with him by taking the ball early and doing what he does instead of deflecting, and it was a really good watch. But Sinner kept getting the break, giving it up, and then eventually he managed to sort of consolidate one of his breaks, and then it felt like de Minaur realized that he had to just go out of his comfort zone to try and live with Sinner, and he couldn't. The errors came, and Sinner took over in that second set completely. An important marker, which he will hope will be a sort of inflection point and will sort of propel him to, getting a really big win at a slam and reaching a first slam final, perhaps at the US Open. Because, as you said, I think maybe I'm in more of a rush for Jannik Sinner's career than he is.
He only wants to qualify for Turin, Matt.
Right, exactly.
Those are his goals.
This year, yeah. That's the goal.
I do think he would be very content with getting to the US Open final. You know, obviously gutted if he ended up losing it, but equally, that's real progress. And that would be progress. That would be a good sign. He probably does have a good perspective on his career. And as I said, he is still making improvements. It's not like he's tailed off or leveled off. They're not like really huge Alcaraz level bursts, but you know, who does that? Carlos Alcaraz. I feel like Sinner is developing at a level that he's comfortable with, and he is going to get there. And a week like this, where he's winning matches that he needs to be winning, is just another sort of step on that road, I suppose.
I'm fully expecting David to come in now and tell us why Jannik Sinner is in the mix for the US Open, even though, as Matt's explained, I don't think Jannik Sinner thinks he's in the mix for the US Open.
I agree with that analysis that he puts limits on himself, which I'm not sure are helpful to his prospects of actually achieving the ultimate goal. And therefore, that methodical nature that you reference will probably mean that he's more likely to win one in 2 or 3 years' time when he actually is sort of backing himself to go do that. I think there is something to that, but I'm not sure that he can fast track that because of just who he is. Maybe he just isn't that guy that can do it, even if he's told he should. Maybe if he had a Brad Gilbert hype man in his corner who was just telling him to shut up and stop that chat, you know, and get on with it, maybe that would hurry him up. But I don't think so. I think he's got the sort of coaching team that suits his personality. He's a methodical human being with a fast twitch, truly explosive game. And I think the two wins that got him to, well, the three wins that got him to this title at the end totally sum up who Jannik Sinner is at his best. You know, he played players that are quite similar to him in Tommy Paul and Alex de Minaur, but he's just plus one, plus two better than they are. You know, he's got bigger strokes. They try to do what he does to him. They just try to stand on the baseline, redirect, use their speed, try to out-hit him. When he's on, he's too good for them. He's too good for them all, other than Djokovic, who's the best in the world ever at that particular brand of tennis, and Carlos Alcaraz, who's otherworldly when he's absolutely on. And I think if Sinner plays like he did the last few days without injuries, there's really only those couple of players, I think, that can beat him in tennis terms. And then there's the mental hold that Medvedev has over him, which I don't completely understand why tennis-wise it's such a bad matchup for Sinner. It clearly is one, but I don't really understand what it is that's the problem. So, you know, that's almost as big a hurdle for him, I think, as getting to that next step in Grand Slams is. Can I beat Daniil Medvedev one day?
I do think with Medvedev, you need a change of pace, a bit of variety, I always think. And that was something I thought de Minaur did really well against Medvedev. He actually used his slice backhand, which, you know, isn't an amazing shot, but it's pretty good. And it just unsettled Medvedev a little bit, changed the rhythm. I feel like Sinner's matches against Medvedev have been very one pace, and it was just a sort of back and forth from the baseline, and Medvedev's really, really comfortable in those matches. But yeah, I agree. I think Sinner's top level right now is probably only behind Alcaraz and Novak Djokovic, and then there's the block with Medvedev.
He pulled out the drop shot a few times yesterday in the final, didn't he, against Alex de Minaur? At surprise moments, and it was really, really effective. And I think the drop shot is very effective against Daniil Medvedev. see his matches against Carlos Alcaraz and his return position on a, well, general court position on a on another planet. So I wonder if that's something that he'll continue to work on with a view to finding the Medvedev kryptonite. I'd love to see him more comfortable at the net, and I feel like it's in him. There's so many moments where he's mid-court and I'm always leaning my body towards the TV, kind of urging him to lean his body weight forward and come in, and the instinct just isn't there. But again, he's methodical. He's got Darren Cahill in his corner, who without question will know that that is something to be worked on in his game. And to be that good and yet still have obvious areas of improvement is a great place to be. And Yannick, I feel pretty confident you're going to get to Turin. So
can I ask
why,
you a question?
Why even bother playing the US Open? You've achieved your goals.
Just on the is he in the mix question mark, I feel like with Yannick Sinner, I'm really fascinated by his US Open draw because of all we've just been talking about with Daniil Medvedev. Is it somewhat draw dependent? If he happened to end up with Carlos Alcaraz as his maybe semi-final opponent, who he's beaten before, but avoiding Djokovic and Medvedev, do you feel like that would swing your view?
Not for me. Matt?
I mean, I guess the chances are he would still have to beat one of those, even if he was on the other side of the draw. He might have to beat them in the final.
I know it's Djokovic, but I'm still thinking the last time that we saw him play, he was bad against Djokovic, wasn't he, in that semi-final? That was bad. His forehand completely deserted him. He would very well have lost even if he had played his best. Okay, it's Novak Djokovic at Wimbledon. But that worries me. That worries me that he didn't show up for that match. And that was the last Grand Slam match I saw him play. So I don't think I'll be talking about having those doubts in a year or two's time. But right now, I still have those doubts.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Did we learn anything new about Alex de Minaur this week? And maybe, well, this might be a stretch, but I feel like could probably put the Alex de Minaur and Ludmila Samsonova conversation together. Like, great week for them. Does it mean anything?
I know you both
love the does it mean anything question.
I do, actually.
go on.
I actually think that it slightly reshapes the way I look at de Minaur in that I didn't think he'd be in this final. Really, I suppose I was looking actually at the Roll of Honor and the finals of the last 20 years before we came on, and there was a spell of 14 out of 16 champions that were all the big four in Canada, but aside from that dominance, it has been one of those tournaments that has had some unlikely champions and unlikely finalists, you know. I think Pablo Carreño Busta was one. When you go to Cincinnati, there was Borna Coric, I think, last year.
I can't tell you, David, the time I spent this week trying to recall who was the champion in the men's champion in Canada last year.
No, it's true. And if you go back before the Big Four came along and started doing what they did, you had a Chris Woodruff winning the title, who was an American I remember well. But my word, if somebody had told me he was going to reach the final one of those and win it, and he beat some proper players to do it. So, you know, but really, I would not have expected de Minaur to reach this final, and particularly given the players he had to beat to do it. And I didn't see the Medvedev match. I was busy enjoying my holiday. But I'm very interested to hear that he used a slightly different tactic to try to overcome Medvedev. And I think that's a really interesting development in itself.
Yeah, I think de Minaur is another one. And he kind of said this in his press conference, that he's aware of sort of some of the the chat around him and this idea of a ceiling. And I think he's out to sort of prove people wrong a bit. And when he plays with that slight chip on his shoulder, I think he can be really effective. And that is something that he has done well this year, beaten more top players. He's got wins this year over Rune, Rublev, Medvedev, Fritz and Nadal going back to the United Cup as well. And he'd kind of been a little bit stuck, I suppose, around 20 in the world. He's now made a jump, quite a big jump, up to 12 in the world. It's his career high. Like, a good goal for him now would be try and qualify for the ATP finals. You know, he's on the cusp. I think he's around 10 or 11 in the race, I think. And that's a really good year for Alex de Minaur so far. And it was tricky because there was a lot of matches that he probably should have lost. Like, you know, if you look at the opponent's perspective, Fritz was 5-1 set point up on him in the first set and didn't win that set. Medvedev had leads in both sets and let them slip. So he sort of fought his way through to that final and there were matches that he definitely could have lost, but he did win them. And I feel like he generally this year has performed better against top players than he had done in the past. And it was just a huge revelation to me that he'd never even reached a quarterfinal of a Masters 1000. He'd lost 16 matches in a row at this level. That is absolutely crazy. When you think of, you know, some players who will have a week and get to a quarter or a semi at a Masters 1000. The fact that one of the most consistent players on tour had never managed to do that was kind of mind-boggling. So that's a big breakthrough for him, just to be able to do that. And obviously he went all the way to the final. With Samsonova, I mean, again, crazily good week. Two top five wins, also beat Bencic, also beat Zhongqin Wen. I don't understand Samsonova. I think she's just going to be one of these players who comes in and out and has great weeks. I mean, she hadn't actually beaten that many top players before, more top five wins this week than she had in her whole career. But I think she's most dangerous against big players. And I think she gets up for those matches. And I think, yeah, she's going to be a bit inexplicable. She's going to have some weeks where she's bombing out and hitting a load of unforced errors and you don't really notice her, and then she's going to pop up and be a huge danger. And I'm not sure we're ever really going to get a grasp on when that will be. She's going to remain a predictions nightmare, I suspect.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Do you remember, was it three-ish years ago, possibly two, and one of the questions in our year-long predictions at the start of the year was, who, in what order will de Minaur, Shapovalov and Auger Aliassime finish up in the rankings this year? Well, de Minaur is now ranked ahead of Felix Auger Aliassime and Denis Shapovalov and is on the up, whereas the other two were very much on the down at the moment. And I just, I remember that absolutely nobody was picking de Minaur to be the standout of those three. And obviously this is just a moment in time. They're all still very young, but I still think it's tremendous for him to be ranked where he is, higher than Nick Kyrgios has ever been ranked right now. And my last annoying question for you on this subject is, I'm just looking at the rankings now. Tommy Paul and Alex de Minaur are now ranked 13 and 12 respectively. And there are only 70 points separating them. Who's more likely to qualify for Turin?
De Minaur.
Where are they in the race?
Yes.
That's a fair question, isn't it?
That's a fair question. We had it out this whole section. Tommy Paul is 12th in L Race. And Alex de Minaur is 10th in L Race. And points-wise, oh my goodness, maths on the spot, there are about 160 points separating them.
I think probably I would back de Minaur. I feel like I would back de Minaur to maybe rack up some more points in that sort of post-US Open indoor period. I feel like he could play like 4 weeks in a row and just sort of rack up quite a few points in that
yes.
period.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure if either of them will actually qualify, but probably Edge goes to Dimonor, which would, you know, considering Tommy Paul reached that Australian Open semi-final in the year, would sort of back up this idea of Dimonor just doing a lot of winning just generally.
Carlos Alcaraz losing to Tommy Paul, patchy week for him. There were still moments of the spectacular. The ceiling was Alcaraz level high, but the floor was quite low this week. It was very up and down. Any concerns for Carlos Alcaraz ahead of his first US Open title defence?
Well, if he plays like that, he ain't winning the US Open. That much is very clear. I feel like what the discussion you had earlier, Matt, about Iga Swiatek playing a lot of three-set matches may end up doing her good at the US Open. I feel the same for Alcaraz. I think not necessarily playing every single match all the time, having to work on the game. Let's be honest, the greats peak at the biggest events. That's how they win all these Grand Slam tournaments. Okay, the big four just shared them all between them every single week, more or less. That's how great they were. But I just feel like this is work in progress stuff for these very top players, and maybe not being at your best now will mean you're at his best during the US Open, but he better be, because that was not close to good enough. Yannick Sinner would have destroyed him this week.
Yeah, maybe Carlos Alcaraz is just going to win the next 12 slams, but just keep losing to Tommy Paul in Canada every year. Because, I mean,
absolutely.
Tommy Paul beat him last year as well. And yeah, I mean, Alcaraz was nowhere near his level this week. Juan Carlos Ferrero wasn't there. I do read something into that. Like, I know Alcaraz has won matches and done plenty well enough without Juan Carlos Ferrero in his box, but that is such an important, strong relationship. We know how much Alcaraz is always looking over to that box. And I felt like he wasn't playing that well. And also, his attitude wasn't quite as good as it normally is. He was getting pretty frustrated. He just slammed his racket down at one point, and he was sort of telling himself, what's happening? I can't play. It was quite negative in a way that normally he's a lot more positive, I suppose. But yeah, I don't have concerns for Alcaraz going into the US Open off the back of that. And Tommy Paul is a player who, again, Chris Clary was tweeting about in terms of among the current crop of American players, Tommy Paul is the one that sort of comes out in all of their sort of metrics as the best athlete, you know, even ahead of like Tiafoe and Fritz and Shelton. You know, Tommy Paul is such a good athlete, and actually if he's having a good day with his forehand, with his movement and his backhand, he can hang and live with Carlos Alcaraz, and he's a great shot maker as well. And yeah, he took advantage of Alcaraz not at his best, but Tommy Paul's a very, very good player with a very high level as well. It wasn't like Alcaraz crashed out to a nobody, but then, you know, I remember us thinking, oh, is it bad that he's lost to Fabian Marajan on the eve of the French Open? And, you know, now no one even remembers that match. Like, it is still about the slams for Alcaraz.
Marcelo Arevalo and Jean-Julien Roger beat Joe Salisbury and Rajiv Ram 6-3, 6-1 to win the doubles title in Toronto, their first Masters 1000 title as a team. Alcaraz is in the top half of the draw in Cincinnati, along with Tsitsipas, Ruud and Rublev. The bottom half sees Novak Djokovic's return to the USA for the first time since the 2021 US Open. Runa, Medvedev and Sinner all in there as well. In the women's event in Cincy, the top half features Świątek, Garcia, defending champion Garcia, Rybakina and Goff. And the bottom half is Sakkari, Pegula, Jabeur, obviously her return for the first time since the Wimbledon final, and Sabalenka. Coming up on the tennis podcast over the course of the next week. We have hashtag content to burn for you. For friends of the pod, we have US Open Relived, the Kim Clijsters story. That is being recorded and will be up for you this week. On our main feed, we will have our regular Cincinnati catch-up show on Thursday. That'll be up for you. We'll have our review show on Monday. That Matt and I will be recording in Heathrow Airport, What Could Go Wrong? And then David will be travelling to New York on Thursday, and then it all kicks off in earnest in New York for the final Grand Slam of the season. Also in New York for the final Grand Slam of the season will be our two winners of our Wilson competition, two friends of the tennis podcast who are each going to the US Open courtesy of Matt's sponsor Wilson, who are also the official ball. They also sponsor the ball at the US Open. That's neither here nor there. The official ball of the US Open. And our winners are Dawn Miller and Mette Sorensen, who is originally from Denmark but now living in Atlanta. So congratulations to them, and do enjoy your time at the US Open. I feel confident you will, because it is very hard not to. We have our mascot for this episode, Shady. Shady is owned by Jesse Flanders. Shady is a 10-year-old terrier mix. He's a graduate of the Arkansas Paws in Prison program, which pairs shelter dogs with prison inmates for training. Love that. Professional trainers work with the inmates and animals several times a week, and after 8 weeks, the pups graduate and go to their forever homes. And Shady is here wearing a bandana that says "Ball is Life" on it, and it's got pictures of tennis balls. Really love that about Shady. I've actually registered Billie Jean this week as a pets as therapy dog to go into prisons and care homes and hospitals and stuff, and generally spread cuddles and joy. She hasn't actually passed the assessment yet, so
oh, she will.
I won't say too much more.
I back her.
But I've registered her to be assessed, so watch this space. And Shady/Jessie, if you have any tips for me for that assessment, please let me know, because Shady has obviously been doing great work and he is gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. So thank you, Jessie, for being a friend of the pod and bringing Shady into our lives. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I've got Xenia. Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. I will be mentioning that casually when the assessor comes round. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And shout outs, along with David Law, are back.
Yes, we start with Katie Chalton, who is in St Albans in the UK.
Hello, Katie. Katie Bolter.
Katie's done us a favour there by being a Katie rather than a Kate.
Yes. Kates we struggle with.
Kates we always end up naming Katies.
Yep. Katie McNally, Katie Bolter. Katies are all over the shop. Mm. But not this Katie. There's only one of you. Thank you very much for being a friend of the pod.
Yeah.
We also have Ray Houston Millett, who is originally from Derry, now living in Bristol. And Ray is Carter's owner from last year. Mascot fame.
Oh, fantastic.
We love Carter. Thank you, Ray. Tennis Rays, David. There must have been some kicking around in the 90s.
Yeah, or earlier. When it was it was a more popular name. Sorry, Ray. Surely Ray is going to make a comeback as a name, the way that Arthur has, for instance. But
we'll
I can't
see.
Think of any. So, sorry, Ray.
I can't think of any.
Look, you're the only tennis Ray that we can think of. So, you know, thanks for being
friend. I can
think
of a Ray Raymond that I don't really want to give a...
Ray Moore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You forced us there, David.
Sorry, Ray. I feel like we've let Ray down with this.
We've let you down, Ray.
I'm going to read out Ray's little story. My earliest tennis memory is the 1993 Wimbledon final. I was a big Jana Novotna fan after this. And very fitting that my first introduction to the tennis podcast was a friend telling me about the Novotna episode.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. You've saved your own shout out, Ray. Yes. Thank you for that. Who's our final shout out for, Matt?
Our final one is David Koller from La Tour de Paix in Switzerland.
Ooh.
Right, Dave. Like David Goffin.
Yes.
Yep. And Ferrer.
Yeah.
Do we have a blurb about David?
I started listening to the podcast, he says, when Matt was still grad Matt. I was a super commuter for 2 years with a weekly 5-hour train ride between Paris and Zurich. Ooh. Your friendly voices kept me company on the countless, lonely, tiring journeys. So even if I don't know you, I'm grateful for you all for having brought cheer and warmth to some joyless moments. Happy ending alert. Oh. Those times being apart from my family are long behind me, but I still enjoy your virtual company just as much.
Oh,
David, that's so nice. Thank you. Really, really nice. And actually, a nice moment, actually, I think, to lead on to a final bonus shout out. David, I think you should be the one to pay tribute to Greg Sharko, who has announced that he's going to be retiring from tennis this year. A name that anybody working in tennis will know very, very well. An incredible contributor to the sport over many, many decades, and someone we've all had the pleasure of working alongside, but you in particular.
Yeah, Greg is somebody who's worked at the ATP, I believe, since 1986. And he was the communications manager at the Queen's Club when I worked at my first ever tennis tournament in 1996. So he'd already been going 10 years when I showed up, and as a very, very nervous 22-year-old, and basically tried to sort of follow him around and learn how to do his job, a job that I didn't even know existed, working between the players and the media, and in order to help them get along and get together and do their press conferences. And Greg would forever be coming up and saying, why don't you just go and give this little bit of information about Luke Jensen that I've got to the British media, because they're going to have a story in the next round because they're playing the British guys, etc., etc. That's how his mind would work. And it was always about something that he knew that he'd figured out might help the media do their jobs. And there's not many that I can think of that think like that within the sport, just sort of selflessly going out there trying to help the media to do their jobs. And I cannot think of really anybody in the sport quite like Greg, who nobody that I've ever met has got a bad word to say about. He is just a gem of a human being, a lovely bloke. He has been, in my view, passed over time and time again when good promotion opportunities might come up, and he never complained. He just got on with his job. He did it to the absolute best of his ability. He did it brilliantly. All of us in the media valued his contributions, and I think that kind of communication style is not valued highly enough. And actually, it's the one that makes journalists want to speak and write more favorably about a sport, because he's out there telling everybody its best side, but telling it from the heart and with the facts and the statistics to back it up. That is service to the sport that he has given. He's loved every minute of it. At the same time, don't get me wrong, it's not like he's hated doing that job. He's loved it. Never ever get into a situation where you challenge him to an eat-off, which I did in 2000 in America, and got absolutely eaten under the table at one of the most disgusting eateries I've ever had the misfortune to attend, and he ate 5 plates of all-you-can-eat spaghetti to my 3. But absolutely lovely bloke, and I hope whatever he's doing next, he enjoys, because he's a top man.
Hear, hear. Yeah, never made it about him, did he? No ego whatsoever, which is unbelievably rare in that kind of role. Look, there are lots of good people doing that kind of stuff, but so often it's about being mates with the players, isn't it? You know, having their phone number in your iPhone. And that's never what it's been about for Greg, although I'm sure he's got a more impressive black book, little black book, than anyone else in the sport. So we will miss you, Greg, but we wish you very well in whatever your retirement holds. And that's it for us on this edition of the Tennis Podcast. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular Midway Cincinnati pod. We'll be back later in the week as well for Friends of the Tennis Podcast with our Kim Clijsters story. And we'll be back next Monday, of course, from Heathrow Airport. We'll speak to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Want truly hydrated skin? Meet Osea's body care breakthrough, Hyaluronic Body Serum. It's clinically proven to increase hydration by 161%. It's lightweight, fast-absorbing, and delivers 24 hours of hydration for silky smooth skin without any sticky afterfeel. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code SUMMER.